Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show. My name is Jonathan Van Maren, and today we're going to be having a discussion with my friend Trevor Paulo. Now, for those of you who recognize his last name, we had his wife, Kristen Paulo, on in January on this podcast to talk about some of the ways that Protect Life Michigan has been developing their strategy and designing it to shift public opinion on the issue. And Kristen Paulo, of course, is the executive director, and Trevor works doing a lot of their strategy and kind of pioneering how they're doing their outreach. And they did a very interesting study, an analysis of abortion victim imagery, as they refer to it. And they released this report in conjunction with our friends at Created Equal. And so I invited Trevor on to talk about this report and some of the interesting things that they found. Here's that conversation. So I'm here today with my friend Trevor Paulo from Protect Life Michigan. Those of you who regularly listen to this podcast will be aware of Protect Life Michigan. At the beginning of the year, we had PLM's executive director and Trevor's wife, Kristen, on to discuss a lot of what they've been doing and some of the videos that they've been releasing. And so after that video was released, which many of you might have seen because many pro-life groups sent it out, including the Pro-Life Action League, Created Equal, and the organization that I work for as well. PLM initiated a large study examining the impact of various strategies on their ability to persuade people to change their minds on the abortion issue. And anybody who's read the news knows that abortion is the number one issue in the U.S. right now. Maybe not for the GOP, but it certainly is for the Democrats. They're trying to make abortion the centerpiece of their campaign. Kamala Harris recently visited an abortion clinic. You had actors advocating for it at the Oscars. And this obviously it provides a challenge for the pro-life movement, but it also provides a huge opportunity for the pro-life movement. And I wish more groups saw it that way, because when the word abortion is on the lips of the entire population, this provides an opportunity for the pro-life movement to define what that word means. So more people talking about abortion is a good thing, and pro-lifers need to take advantage of that. So what led you guys to initiate this study in the first place?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Ultimately, at Protect Life Michigan, we want to do what is most effective, and most effective specifically at changing public opinion on the issue of abortion. And we recognize that, you know, we didn't always support the use of victim imagery at Protect Life Michigan, as groups like the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform, as well as Create Equal, that helped us change our position on that. But we want to make sure that, you know, we have this anecdotal evidence, we have historical evidence for the use of these images from other social reform movements of the past, but we want to make sure that we have the data, the real proof that this is an effective strategy, because if it's not, we don't want to use it anymore. We don't enjoy using it. It's not fun to necessarily use these images. So if it's not working, we want to abandon it and pivot immediately. We also want to help the rest of the pro-life movement, like you're saying, see this as an opportunity this year. There's an election going on where abortion's at the center of the debate. There's a Supreme Court case that's going to be ruled on in June talking about the abortion pill. The Republican Party is pretty much retreating from the issue of abortion, as well as some pro-life groups that are retreating from the core issue of whether abortion is morally right or morally wrong, and trying to argue on the peripheral of the issue. So we need to show that we can actually have a strategy that changes public opinion on the core issue of the morality of abortion. And if that works, if we can prove that works, help evangelize that to other pro-life people and other pro-life groups so that we can have a more cohesive and targeted and effective strategy as a movement, not just at Protect Life Michigan.
So I'm a huge fan of this approach, which is to say, I don't think that there are strategies that are morally imperative. I think there are strategies that we are morally impelled not to use, such as violence. But I don't think that any one strategy, as long as they are a more morally permissible one, is something that we need to do. And so what we need to be doing is we need to be driven by effectiveness. As you said, what changes the most minds, what ultimately saves the lives of preborn children, because any pro-life group that isn't changing minds or saving children is simply not doing what they were created to do and isn't doing what they're taking donor money to do. You wouldn't donate money to an orphanage that wasn't feeding any orphans. And so pro-life groups need to be changing minds. And so how did you structure this study? And I'm particularly interested because listeners of the podcast will know that CCBR has initiated multiple large-scale polls here in Canada on the issue of abortion victim photography for the same reason. We wanted to test the effectiveness. We were completely prepared and are still prepared to use a different strategy if we find one that is more effective. And so I kind of have some idea of how difficult it can be to structure a study and structure a poll to ensure that you can properly measure the impact. So how did you guys go about that? What was the methodology behind this?
Yeah. So we distributed the poll to 1,200 adults in the US. And when that poll, when they started taking the poll, unbeknownst to them, they were divided into one of two groups, an A group and a B group. The A group would see questions 3 through 10 while looking at an image of abortion victim of an abortion victim. There's three different images that would be randomly assigned to each question. The B group, the other 600-ish adults, would be seeing a pro-life message, so kind of like a social media graphic, basically, that had a pro-life message on it, such as abortion is a human rights violation, or pro-life, pro-woman, pro-equality, or some other message like that. So they're seeing a pro-life kind of apologetic, a brief apologetic. And what we did is ask both groups the same question and compare the results between the groups to say, to understand how just by changing the image that we present to somebody, does it influence their answer? And we really tried to say, like, okay, what are the questions that we want to answer? We want to understand if when we use victim imagery, does it make people feel more or less supportive of abortion? Obviously, that's the most important question. However, that wasn't the one that necessarily I was most interested in, because to your point, we have a lot of data that already supports that it does, especially from your organization. But we did answer it. We still did ask it. Well, some of the other questions that we were most interested in is, how does this make them feel about pro-life people that use victim imagery? Because a very common objection that we hear from the pro-life side is you're turning people away from the pro-life argument or the pro-life position or pro-life organizations by using these very divisive or upsetting or triggering images. You're actually like ingraining or further solidifying pro-choice people because they're so upset at pro-life people. But we also want to understand, you know, did these images make an unborn child seem more human, for example? Does it humanize the unborn child, or does it have no effect on how they view children? Or and does it translate to legislative support or opposition for abortion bans? So that's kind of the basic structure of how we did it. And the results were very interesting.
So let's kind of walk through those, because what I found very interesting about this study, and I've got it pulled up right here in front of me on my computer as we're chatting, is that you're correct. What it did was it went beyond what we did. So we've done five actually, major polls, some of which we've released publicly. All of which showed a very high rate of people seeing images and then feeling far more negatively about abortion as a result or changing their minds. We also have conversation trackers where we can kind of determine of the people who stop and speak to us on the street when we have our displays out, what number of them go from pro-choice to pro-life, etc. But you guys asked a number of corollary questions that are also interesting. So kind of work your way through some of the ones that you just mentioned. So if we're looking at, say, how the image makes them feel about pro-life people, like how do these things pan out in your poll?
Yeah. So, it was very, interesting because, so when we looked at people who, were given non, victim imagery photos to look at while they're answering these questions, around 31% of people said when they saw just a pro-life graphic, basically, they felt negatively towards pro-life people. And I think that's probably to be expected because there is a large, there's, you know, 30% of people might be very strong pro-choice people. And if I imagine as a pro-life activist, if I see a pro-choice graphic, I'm going to be upset at pro-choice people because I think they're doing something morally wrong by sharing that graphic, by advocating for the death of children, right? So I basically am like, no matter what we say, 31% of people are going to be upset at pro-life people, right? So that's our baseline because those graphics are not that divisive. So then we're like, okay, well, let's look at the group that was asked the same question while looking at the image of a dead child. And the question was basically, well, how would you feel towards pro-life people that were using this image as a form of advocacy? And that 31% went up to just over 40% in the group that was seeing the victims of abortion. So roughly a 10% increase in negative feelings towards pro-life people for using that image. And that's, you know, it's definitely like statistically significant. It's definitely less than I thought it would be.
Slower than I thought it would be.
Yeah. I was like, maybe I thought there'd be more people would be upset at us than just a 10% increase compared to the non-victim imagery group. But it's still, you know, it's something to consider. You know, if that goes up by 10% and images don't work very well, then we should probably avoid using those images. But we also looked at, okay, when they have more negative feelings towards pro-life people, was that also accompanied by an increased negative feeling towards abortion itself? And when we looked at that, it was very clear that while it did increase negative feelings towards pro-life people, it was about a 2-to-1 increase in negative feelings towards abortion compared to that. So like for every 1% they have negative feeling increase towards pro-life people, it was accompanied by a 2% increase in negative feelings towards abortion. So it's a great return on our investment. Like, again, goal is not to make friends by using these images or anything. It's a bad strategy if you're trying to get people to like you. But if my goal is to make people feel more negatively about abortion, then it's clear that a victim imagery does do that thing.
What about some of the other corollary research questions that you went through? What did you find there? On this particular question, I just kind of wanted to add, because this is a common criticism that I don't particularly see as a criticism, because I think it's a misunderstanding of the goal of pro-life outreach, right? If this would make sense to me, if you are in the context of a crisis pregnancy center and you're counseling somebody, and essentially your ability to communicate with this person depends on how they feel about you, the counselor. So in that context, I understand that you have to be very very aware of what kind of messaging you're giving, especially initially on in the conversation. For public outreach, though, it's a completely different question. And what we've found in Canada and in more blue states, to be honest, is that regardless of what kind of pro-life advocacy you're doing, as you noted, people are going to feel negatively if they have an opposing view. And so in Canada, for example, you know, there was a woman who got attacked, you know, at LifeChain by a guy with a knife in Toronto. And LifeChain is like, you know, adoption the loving option, right? Like even the slogans are pretty anodyne and I would say pretty uncontroversial. You know, I had a friend who got punched in the face for sidewalk chalking, you know, in Toronto as well. And again, they were like, I love babies messages and things like that. And so my expectation is that when you're heading into a contentious and controversial debate in which people hold very strong feelings, you have to expect some backlash, period. And so the idea that if you use abortion victim images, you're essentially incurring a backlash, whereas if you're taking a softer approach, or I would say using less evidence to support your position, then you're going to get, you know, a consequently less aggressive approach fails on the face of it. It fails anecdotally. It largely fails with data. And what I actually find kind of interesting is that when you make an assertion without evidence, you often end up being in a position where people just think, what a jackass, right? Like, that's just not true. Whereas when you're showing them an image that genuinely causes them to stop and think and probably causes some conflict, the intellectual distress they feel when they're faced by this image is productive, because what we're doing there is we're displaying our conclusion rather than just asserting a premise. And so, yeah, the entire history of social reform indicates that you're going to make people upset by confronting them with upsetting truths that are going on. That said, I was surprised by your guys' data that there was only a 10% jump. I would have guessed 20 to 25% easily and wouldn't even have been surprised if it was higher.
And the interesting thing is that so we asked people if they felt more negative towards pro-lifers and they could choose, no, or they felt more positive. But like the two negative options were, yes, I felt more negative, or yes, I felt a lot more negative, very negative views towards pro-lifers. And when we pulled out the people who said they had very negative views towards pro-lifers for using victim imagery, and we compared who said that, because one of the first questions we asked is basically what they thought about abortion before they saw any images. We said, do you think that it's morally right and justified? Do you think it's morally wrong and not justified? Or are you in the middle? And when we compared those three groups and how they viewed pro-lifers, the group that had the strongest negative views towards pro-lifers using victim imagery were the strong pro-choice group, those who thought abortion was morally right and justified, which makes sense, like you were saying. The second group that had the most negative feelings towards pro-lifers for using victim imagery was pro-lifers. Strong pro-life people had the second highest rate of very negative feelings towards pro-lifers. The group that had the least strong negative feelings towards pro-lifers was the mushy middle of the population, the group that is persuaded on the issue of abortion, which is exactly who we should be targeting with this strategy. They also, that same mushy middle group, was the most affected, had the most negative feelings towards abortion when seeing victim imagery. On average, about 49% of people expressed less support for abortion when they saw victim imagery compared to 31%. Or 32% that were seeing just a generic pro-life graphic. But when we again split it out by what group those people were, over 60% of people who were in the middle on the issue of abortion had less support for abortion when they saw these images compared to that same mushy middle group that was just seeing a generic pro-life graphic. So when we're thinking about like, okay, how can we be strategic with our time, our investment, our persuasion strategy? We should be looking at what moves the middle, and they're most moved by victim imagery, and they're least likely to feel upset at pro-lifers for to have strong negative feelings towards pro-lifers for using it. It's actually the extremes of the issue, the strong pro-lifers and strong pro-choicers that have the most negative feelings towards pro-lifers. And frankly, that doesn't really bother me that much. I'm here to change the middle of the population.
Agreed. So what else did you guys find corollary to the issue?
Yeah, one of the other questions that we asked was, or one of the goals, I guess, of abortion victim imagery is really to bring humanity to the unborn child. You see, the abortion industry thrives by making the victim of abortion seem less than human, and they dehumanize them with the words they use, like clump of cells or tumor or parasite or whatever. They also dehumanize them by keeping them anonymous and treated as if they're just medical waste. So the only way that we can really humanize that child is by bringing an image of a person, or humanize anybody that's being abused. It's by using images of them. That's why the images of slavery were so effective at changing public opinion. The images of the Holocaust are so effective. The images that were used in the civil rights movement are so effective is because they made this victim look just like you and I. So we now identify with this person who's being abused. So when we asked questions about the unborn child, when we were using victim imagery, we asked one of the questions was, do you think the child experiences pain during an abortion procedure? Basically, like, the experience of pain is a very human thing for us to identify with. It's very primal for us. So we asked, do you think it happens? And we didn't give any like biological evidence for fetal pain or anything like that. We didn't say at what week or anything. We just said, look at this image. Do you think they experience pain? And when we asked that question, the non-AVI group, the group that was just seen a generic picture or graphic, about 42% of people thought that the unborn would experience pain during an abortion procedure. And when they looked at the image of abortion, that group that had that was seen an image of abortion, that number jumped to over 56%. So we can get a majority of people to identify with identify as someone who understands fetal pain just by using the image of abortion, which obviously intuitively I think makes sense. When you see someone who's had their heads crushed, their arms and legs are ripped off, like, you think that that's painful, that's violent, that's disgusting, right? So we need to use these images to help bring some of that human element. And if we can start making them see the unborn as like themselves, something that experiences pain, someone who has a face, someone who has arms and legs, it's much harder to advocate for the destruction of that person when you have that, when you have that level of humanization.
Was there anything in this data that surprised you beyond the feelings of negativity?
I think one of the last things that there's probably two things actually. So one of the last questions that we asked was just on a scale of 1 to 10, how strongly do you support abortion? Meaning one would be you are completely opposed to abortion. 10 would be you're completely in support of abortion throughout the pregnancy. And a couple of key things that we found is that abortion victim imagery worked the most, or much better, I guess, with men versus women. And I've got theories. I don't really necessarily have any proof as to why, but like some theories I think is that like, I think men sometimes have a greater level of ignorance around abortion and pregnancy and fetuses and all sorts of stuff. And it's very easy for them to be like, I had no idea. And they see this evidence and become more pro-life. Women, that it was still positive, it still moved in our direction with it, but it was less significant. Education and race, minorities were moved significantly more by victim imagery than white people. Less educated people were generally moved more by victim imagery than more educated people, with the exception of people with graduate degrees. You see, we actually, if they went to graduate school, they started, the non-victim imagery group had the strongest pro-choice leanings, were the individuals that went to graduate school, and they were most supportive of abortion, especially if they were a white person that went to graduate school. But that same group that went to graduate school that got exposed to victim imagery had the greatest shift towards the pro-life position. The greatest difference in the two answers were in people that were highly educated, which was very surprising to me. And I'm not exactly sure why, but like they had the largest shift when they saw victim imagery. And the other thing that was a little surprising was I expected more correlation from negative feelings towards abortion to increased support for legislation that would ban restrict abortion. And we saw some of this. So we asked like basically a question about a total ban on abortion. How likely would it be to support a total ban on abortion? We did include an exception for rape and incest in the life of the mother, mostly because that's kind of the standard right now for anyone that's proposing a ban on abortion in the United States. Like it almost has to include that at this point politically. But when we asked that question, there was an increase of about 6% in support for that near total ban with the victim imagery group versus the non-victim imagery group. However, what we expected was that that level of support would go up when we asked next about a heartbeat ban, and then next when we asked about a 15 to 20 week ban. However, it did not go up with that AVI group. It remained steady within about 1 or 2% for each level of the ban. It did go up with the non-AVI group from a total ban to a heartbeat ban, for example, but not with the AVI group. And why that is something that I think we need to do a little more digging on and understanding. One theory I have is that if I am seeing the image of a victim of abortion and I'm asked, do I support banning abortion? And I say, yes, a complete total, near total ban on abortion. And then later I get asked, do you think abortion should be okay for the first 6 to 8 weeks of pregnancy? As the next question, there might be a significant portion of the people that are like, that's actually too moderate, too liberal, too accepting of abortion. When I'm seeing this image of a dead child, I can't support a heartbeat ban, because not because I think it's too strict, but because I think it's too liberal on this issue. That's a theory that probably needs more investigation, but unfortunately the translation of legislative support still needs more studies, because we didn't see the same impact on legislative support that we saw on decreased support for abortion in general. And part of it might be just political identity is a very different thing to break through than just questions about abortion. Like someone, if I'm a progressive liberal Democrat, to advocate for a legislative policy that counters my political party, when the political party is so entrenched with the abortion industry, is a very difficult thing to get someone to commit to immediately like that. So I think we have to figure out more and more ways to break through that political identity and separate it from the issue of abortion as much as possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because so our polling found something different. Not the data set that we released with Created Equal, but another one that we did. We actually found that the imagery had the most impact on women ages 18 to 34. They were the most likely to change their mind on seeing the image, and that the one group that had almost nil impact on was women over 60 weren't budged at all. like basically the image had like a, it was sort of like in the margin of error kind of thing. On the political identity thing, and of course the US and Canada are wildly different countries when it comes to the role abortion has played in our politics. We found in that huge data set that we released with Created Equal, which this is after we dropped postcards in a million mailboxes and we released all of that data. It's online for anyone who wants to see it. But we found too that it was very difficult. So we would have people who saw the image and were horrified by abortion, were totally up for changing their mind, felt much more negatively about abortion. But although there was an increase in people who said they were willing to vote pro-life, it wasn't very significant. Like I wasn't surprised, but I was disappointed by the extent to which people did not correlate their view on abortion with their view of who they should vote for. And what our conclusion was essentially that when people rank their ballot issue, as in the issue that they're showing up to vote on, abortion just doesn't rank very high for the vast majority of people. And there's like a small handful of us who vote on that issue, period. Like I will not vote for a pro-abortion candidate, even if I support him or her on everything else. I just won't. I wouldn't vote for the KKK in the 30s either. Like there are some moral issues that I think are completely overriding. But we know that even many, many, many pro-life people are okay with voting for a pro-abortion candidate. So it shouldn't necessarily surprise me that just because somebody changes their mind on the issue, wouldn't personally get an abortion, would hopefully discourage it in his or her peers, isn't necessarily willing to make that the issue that they cast their ballot on exclusively. And so, although I think we have a lot of data on how you shift people on abortion, which is incredibly helpful in my view for these direct democracy initiatives, where you're isolating the issue of abortion and that's the only issue you're voting on, it's, you know, an up or down kind of thing. All of the research that we've collectively done is very helpful there. I don't know what it looks like to actually make people, to make abortion their primary ballot issue.
Yeah, and I think that really kind of hits it on the head because, you know, there's all these polls that come out in the U.S. about, you know, rank these issues in order of importance politically, and they'll have 10 options, you know, immigration, taxes, abortion, marriage, all kinds of stuff. And when you ask a Democrat or left-leaning person, abortion will often be, at least especially right now after Dobbs, often be one of the top 1, 3, 5 issues that they make their political decisions off of. For a Republican or a conservative voter, we're lucky if abortion makes the top 10 often in their political decision making. And I think that one of the core reasons for that is because if you're pro-choice, you're often going to identify the victim related to the abortion issue as the woman that's in crisis. And obviously for pro-life people, we also identify the woman as a victim, often in these cases as well. But the pro-choice person is gonna overemphasize her as the sole person of or deserving attention or justice in that situation and neglect the unborn child. Whereas the conservative side will rightly focus more on the unborn child. Now, why I think that impacts their order of their how importantly they consider these different issues politically is the pro-choice person can more readily identify with their victim, the woman. It's much easier for you to identify with that woman and the experience they're going to, because you might be currently a woman, or you might be someone who has a sister or a daughter or a wife or a mother. You understand the crisis that woman could go through much better and much more accessibly than you can understand the victim being the unborn child. None of us, it's very difficult for us to really empathize, especially for the average person, with a fetus, right? Like we can't recall being a fetus. We don't like interact with a fetus. We don't, it's much more obtainable to think about the woman. And I think that means that it's much easier for them to rank that as a high issue for them to be concerned about, because the victim is so readily available to them to care about. For us, we're saying, hey, care more about this fetus that you don't have as much of an emotional connection with as a woman, maybe, and care about it more than you care about these other political issues. That's a harder ask to make of people, but it becomes easier if you can help them identify more and more with the fetus. And that's something that we can't do very well with words and with stories and things like that. We have to do it with images. You're going to identify more with a fetus if you see the face of a child. You see the violent destruction of a child. Now you can identify with yourself or with your daughter or your newborn or this experience that helps them identify more of the victim. And until we start doing that and making and leading with our victim more and more, we're going to be allowing them, the pro-choice side, to have the sole presentation of the victim being this woman in crisis really shifts the way that people view this issue and makes it a hot topic for them that is driving donations and electoral victories. And when we respond with anything other than our victim as a response, we're going to lose over and over and over.
So you got a couple things there that I think are important, because I agree with you completely that facilitating a face-to-face connection with the victims is one of the essential tasks of the pro-life movement. And that's what that was the premise of CCBR's Faces Tour this past summer, which was an emphasis on connecting with the victims on a human level. But I want to go back to something that you had mentioned in the data, because I think it applies directly to the political situation, where you talk about how the people on the fringes were the most put off by the projects, right? So you got the hardcore pro-choicers were very likely to be choked at you, but then also a lot of pro-lifers, which that is probably the least surprising thing in all of your data. And it's because a lot of pro-lifers want to be like, well, like I'm pro-life, but I'm not like one of those guys, right? I don't want to make a big deal about it, right? I don't want to make a big kerfuffle. We don't want to cause what, you know, MLK called creative tension, the creative tension which causes change, right? We have a false peace right now where, you know, hundreds of babies in this country, thousands in yours, are being killed every day silently and out of sight. And it's a profoundly uncomfortable thing, both for pro-life and pro-choice people, to expose that, to engage in that conversation, to face the reality of the communities that we live in, the countries that we live in. But that extrapolates directly, I think, to the Republicans, who the Republican Party has always been kind of a mix on abortion, in that they recognized that Roe v. Wade was a phenomenal way to drive a significant number of voters in some really important states to the polls, and that they could just promise to appoint the right judges without ever directly legislating on abortion. Or if they did, they knew that the law wasn't going to be implemented, so they wouldn't have to deal with the backlash. And that as a result, it was always worth it to come out as hardcore pro-life as you needed to be. And I wrote at the time that there was plenty of pro-life Republicans, I think, who were probably very, very worried the day that Roe v. Wade got overturned. Because both the Democrats and the Republicans used Roe v. Wade as a rallying call to get out the vote. And when Republicans knew that when Roe v. Wade went down, there were going to be states that were actually serious about being pro-life. Those states would pass laws that they would be obliged to defend or retreat from, and that they would also be asked to do something or not do something on a federal level. They were totally unprepared for it, which is bizarre to me. It makes me wonder if they actually believed their own rhetoric that Roe was going to be overturned, because we knew what their playbook was going to look like. We knew what kind of stories were going to get published. It was the same playbook pre-73. It's a playbook unfolding Ireland 2018, Argentina 2020, right? You work your way down the list. This is not new stuff. But it's some of the statements that are coming out now that really concern me and make me think that the pro-life movement is going to have to prepare itself for a season where we have far fewer friends than we did, you know, on June 21, 2022. Because I don't know if you saw this, but Kellyanne Conway did an interview where she was pressed by the host on the position on abortion and said, well, you know, people believe that life begins at conception, like an embryo is a human being worthy of protection. She said, oh, that's a pretty fringe view. Like, she dismissed the idea that an embryo was a human being. And the host actually looked shocked. He's like, that's not a fringe view. Like, that's the view of the pro-life movement. And Kellyanne Conway has worked for a lot of pro-life groups. She's done a lot of data work for a lot of pro-life groups. She's not an idiot, which means she knows that life begins at conception, or she doesn't know that. She knows that's what we believe and what we stipulate and what the science says. I was at the March for Life when she spoke there, kind of declaring all these truths that she's now backing away from. And the only conclusion I can reach, which is really unfortunate when it comes to somebody like her who was involved in the pro-life movement prior to becoming, somebody working for Donald Trump, is that either she thinks that the babies are worth selling out for electoral victory for the big picture, or she never believed it to begin with. And either of those, I think, are true for a lot of Republicans. There's plenty of Republicans who are willing to use preborn babies for political votes and are now willing to abandon them for political votes because it was never about the babies to begin with. But just as a lot of pro-lifers are looking at the heated abortion debate and thinking, like, you know what, I'm sick of defending this. You know, I'm sick of reading all these horrifying stories in the New York Times and the Chicago Sun-Times and things like that. I don't want to talk about this. And a lot of Republicans are not only backing down, but in Kellyanne Conway's case, like deliberately repudiating scientific truths about the reality of human life in the womb, that I do think the pro-life movement has to be prepared to really take it on the chin from both sides going forward. What's your analysis on what the landscape looks like right now? Do I sound way off and way too pessimistic?
No, and I think you're right, because one of the successes that the pro-life movement had over the past several decades has been by kind of maneuvering the political landscape. We had this Roe v. Wade was in place, which means that like we couldn't actually propose a significant abortion ban at all. So we had to maneuver politically to get whatever restrictions we could to try to get the justices in place that we needed, to try to get the legislative support there to move some, you know, restrictions or regulations, things like that. So like we became very good at maneuvering political schemes and things like that. And that was great. We had to do it. And it led to a lot of lives being saved and pro-life advancements. Roe v. Wade being overturned was necessary, but came with the cost of losing that shield that basically meant that we could operate without much pushback from the pro-choice side. The pro-choice side, like, obviously they didn't like our pro-life victories, but it wasn't significant enough for them to really be activated at a mass level when we're operating in this kind of like schemery, right?
And they fundraised a lot from it.
Right, exactly. So now they're activated and they're moving in force, and we're kind of falling into the Republican Party, and now even a lot of pro-life groups are falling into a self-fulfilling prophecy, basically, where we're like, hey, look, the abortion issue isn't something that we can win on. So let's argue about other parts, like peripheral issues. So instead of talking about abortion directly, about whether or not it does kill a child at the earliest stages of pregnancy, let's talk about late-term abortion or let's talk about parental consent, or let's talk about how wide the hallway should be at an abortion clinic and try to make sure that, you know, abortion is safe. Or let's talk about messages like choose life or make the loving choice or things like that, where we're like, we're not talking about the issue itself. And then when we lose, when we do that, like in Michigan and Ohio and these other states that are coming up this year, and we lose, we're like, hey, look, see, abortion is not a winnable issue. And it's like, well, we weren't talking about abortion, remember? We were talking about other things, and we lost by talking about other things. And it's making you feel like we can't win on abortion because we're losing. But I think the reason we're losing is because we're using a losing strategy by letting them define the issue regarding what abortion really is. It's being about women's safety. And then we echo the same things back. We're like, yeah, it is about women's safety. It's about making sure that abortion clinics are regulated and that children have to have their parents informed before they kill their child. Or
who cares?
They now have defined the issue as whether or not women will be safe. And if you ask someone about women's safety, they're not going to fall on the side of banning abortion. Like, it doesn't make sense for them to do so. They're going to fall on the side of making sure abortion is safe and legal and accessible. And maybe they'll support some regulations for it.
Abortion only hurts women if it kills their babies. So if you're making the case abortion hurts women, vote against abortion. Nobody's going to believe that unless they understand what abortion is. So you don't win that argument without winning the abortion argument first. Right. All of these arguments that are being put forward in these referendums are downstream arguments. Like, why would you care about parental consent if abortion doesn't kill a baby?
Right.
Right. You may be kind of peeved that, like, you know, you didn't get told because, hey, it's my kid. But that's not going to beat the narrative they're putting out.
Right. Could you imagine like making arguments like we need to, help plantation owners in the South choose freedom for their slaves, choose freedom for their Africans? That argument like might make people like kind of like feel positively about the abolition movement or anything, but like you're giving the idea that slavery is a choice that someone should be allowed to make, and some people should choose not to enslave and some people should choose slavery. Like, no, we need to start talking about abortion as a choice that no person should be able to make, because it is a moral wrong in all cases. And we're failing to do that. We're losing when we fail to do that. And we think that it's because we're talking about abortion too much, when it's actually because we're the only ones not talking about abortion in a persuasive way, and the other side is, and they're winning and they're going to continue winning if we don't change our strategy.
Yeah, because there's a couple of things that I think the pro-life movement, at least the activist wing of which we are a part of, needs to prepare for. And it's that as frustration mounts, as long as we keep on, so there are some states in which you're going to lose a referendum fair and square on the ballot question. There are some states where there's going to be more pro-abortion people than pro-life people. I think that we've lost referendums that were winnable, but that we lost because we didn't fight the battle on the polling question. We fought it on subsidiary issues that only matter if you win on the main thing. But so as frustration mounts, you're going to have a lot of blame game. You're going to have a lot of people trying to pull back. You've got pro-life groups, like one of the major group in your state, Michigan, who said like people don't change their minds quickly. You can't have conversations where that happens. And like, you know, that's your state. You don't have to say anything about that. But it makes me very angry, because essentially a statement like that is telling everybody who supports that organization and all their donors, like, nothing can be done. So one, it's an excuse for failure. And when you take money to save babies, you don't get an excuse for failure. We would not accept that again from an orphanage. We wouldn't accept that from a mission organization. We wouldn't accept that from a homeless shelter or a food bank, right? Like, I'm sorry, we would love to feed people. There's just no effective way to do it. So we'll keep on taking your money though and telling you about how much things suck. Like, those people, I think, should be ashamed of themselves. Secondarily, because the only way they can make that claim is by asserting that pro-lifers who are seeing minds changed and babies saved and can prove this anecdotally and statistically are lying. That all of us are not having the experiences that we're having, that all of our volunteers and our staff members and our colleagues are not having the experiences that they're having. And this is a very insidious excuse for failure that deliberately demoralizes the pro-life movement at a time where we need to be encouraged that even though macro battles have been lost, micro victories that mean the difference between life and death for individual babies are very, very possible. Here is not just how it is done. Here it is how it is being done. And that collectively speaking, we can start to, you know, roll this rock back uphill. It took 50 years to overturn Roe. I don't think 2 years of ballot losses in which we primarily lost by following idiot consultants. I don't think that should discourage us. And so there's that, I think, that we have to face. But secondarily, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, and anybody who's read me consistently knows that, although I'm very grateful for some of the pro-life things that he's done. But surely the one thing everybody could have taken away from his meteoric political rise is the fact that the consultants who try to teach people careful marketing strategies are useless. Right? Trump was the first candidate who talked about abortion like ripping a baby from the womb of its mother. And that's what worked with voters. Like, it upset me that he was the first one to actually have the guts to start articulating abortion in really blunt terms. But if we've learned anything from Trump, it's that the old rule book doesn't apply. That speaking in carefully couched terms and splicing wedge issues isn't particularly effective. And yet we're hiring the consultants who failed to predict everything that's happened over the last 8 years to run our referendums for us.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, society does not want to change. Society is designed to remain stable. Like you as an individual, you don't like changing your mind typically. Society is just a whole bunch of us deciding we don't want to change. So the way that we generate change, or anyone's going to generate change, is by forcing people to adapt, by creating tension in their mind lines, creating tension and culture. And Donald Trump did that effectively. He created tension in the political sphere that that everyone else was like, don't do that. Don't cause all this discombobulation of everything. Don't say these things. And it worked effectively for him. And right now there is tension being created by the around the abortion issue. Unfortunately, we're not the ones creating enough of the tension. The tension's being created by the other side, who are saying, look, if you support pro-life laws, there's going to be dead women on the streets of America because they're going to be denied abortions and they're going to die. Your daughter's going to die. Your wife's going to die. Your sister's going to be dead. Like, they're creating and they're forcing people to confront, to adapt, basically. And unfortunately, they're adapting to the wrong side of the issue right now. And we're responding not by creating our own tension, but trying to dissuade or trying to distract or trying to do something else from the tensions being created. And it's like fighting against an army with a toy gun. Like, we're not going to be effective against that strategy. We need to go and create the tension that we know needs to be created, which is tension that is centered around why we're against abortion. I'm not against abortion because I think minors should have permission from their parents to get one, or that I think it's just dangerous to go to an abortion clinic. I'm against abortion because it violently kills a human being. So we need to start creating tension that is centered around that source to combat the story, the lies, and the story that's being told by the other side.
Final question. Because I've kept you even longer than I said. The final question would be, Protect Life Mission's got some really big projects that are starting this summer. They're really exciting. I've seen some of the plans for them. So why don't you, the audience who's been listening should hopefully be feeling a combination of resignation to a long fight ahead, but also encouragement that we do know what works and that there are pro-lifers working every day on the ground to implement that. And so perhaps we can end this this podcast by exacerbating that encouragement with you sharing some of the news about how Pro-Life Michigan plans to implement the findings.
Yeah. So, like you said, we have all this anecdotal. We track every conversation we have with people. We've done this study. We've been doing outreach of hundreds of thousands of conversations with people. And you know, we were just doing an outreach last week at Western Michigan University, and 46% of people changed their mind in a conversation on the spot on abortion. Now, that 46% of people, we're talking about a few dozen people in a day that we were able to get to change their mind. So we need to scale that. So we know what works, but we can't change 46 people's minds or dozens of people's minds every single day and expect a state as big as Michigan to change in the next several years. So we have to figure out a way to scale that strategy, scale those tactics, so that it's mass public persuasion that we're effectuating. And that's what we're doing this summer. We're descending into a community in the Metro Detroit area. We have a full-time internship with dozens of high school and college kids that are going to be working 40 hours a week to go out and change minds. We're actually co-opting some strategies that are being used right now by the left to advance LGBTQ movement related initiatives, jail reform, and even abortion initiatives, and starting to use those to change minds on the issue of abortion door to door. We're investing in mass media, connecting TV ads, digital displays, video, abortion video, and all sorts of things to try to say, here's a strategy that worked, a microcosm what worked, here's how we scaled it to a large community, and here's how we can scale it now to a state or to a country. And we hired polling firms to poll before, during, and after this initiative so that we can prove what worked, how well it worked, who it worked on, what demographics and things. And then we plan to export this strategy to as many states, as many communities, whether you're one person trying to change your neighborhood or one group trying to change your state or trying to advance your own initiative, respond to one. This strategy, this persuasion pipeline, is a strategy that can be reproduced and scaled up across the movement to hopefully retake the momentum that has been taken from us since the Dobbs decision.
Fantastic, Trevor. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my conversation with Trevor Paulo. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. If you'd like to check out the podcast, head over to lifesitenews.com. Click on the podcast tab. You'll find the Van Maren Show there, and you can get our content wherever you download your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.